Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This week, we aired our second week-long series on California's water crisis. Over the past year, we've focused on everything from groundwater and food choices to bottled water and Californians living without running water. You can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. On today's media roundtable, we are talking about media coverage of these issues. Governor Jerry Brown's recent water restrictions mandate is receiving national attention and a lot of criticism for giving agriculture a pass, which uses 80% of the state's water. Joining us to talk about coverage of these issues is Matt Weiser, senior reporter with the Sacramento Bee, where he covers water and the environment. Matt also freelances for a number of publications, including National Geographic. He's got a new piece called Lucrative But Thirsty Almonds Come Under Fire Amid Drought. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We are also talking about the historic water crisis in Brazil. Earlier this year, people took to the streets of Sao Paulo to protest water shortages. According to reports, the government is planning to bring out the military for fear the drought there could spark social unrest in that city of 11 million citizens. Mauricio Savarese is a freelance journalist and former reporter with Reuters based in Sao Paulo. Hi, Mauricio. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Your Call's Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Matt Weiser with the Sacramento Bee, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, one article that stood out for me was a piece on Tuesday, May 5th, by a columnist with Bloomberg by the name of Justin Fox. And it's water-related. He wrote a column about the claim that's often made that a lot of California water is wasted on environmental purposes. And I thought it was noteworthy because it's a complicated thing to explain, and he obviously spent a lot of time trying to understand what's really going on, and he concluded that these claims are often not as substantial as they sound, and there really isn't a lot of surplus water that ends up going to environmental purposes in California.
And what does he mean when he says environmental purposes?
Well, he's addressing complaints that often come from farmers in California, which say that water should not be used to sustain fisheries in the California Delta. Instead, it should be pumped out of the Delta whenever it's available to serve farms and, in some cases, cities, depending on who's doing the complaining.
And where can citizens get more information about that? So it's not just a sort of he said, she said.
Well, that's difficult because the water decisions are made at high levels and sometimes behind the scenes. And I suppose it's a good example because it points to the need for good media coverage of these things and for journalists who have the time to delve into the complexities and make them easier to understand. Unfortunately, I can't point to an easy place for people to go to make sense of these water diversions on their own.
Well, we'll definitely talk about this throughout the show, and we'll put a link to that Bloomberg piece at yourcallradio.org. That is Matt Weiser. He's a former senior reporter with the Sacramento Bee. He now freelances, and he covers water and the environment. And what about you, Mauricio? Mauricio Savarese is a freelance journalist and former reporter with Reuters in Sao Paulo. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, one thing that has something to do with the water crisis, but more to do with Brazil's political moment, which is, of course, very divisive since the elections, is a report published by Folha de São Paulo, Brazil's leading newspaper, talking about São Paulo state government, who is also responsible for the water crisis, sponsoring indirectly a group of online trolls that go after journalists, that go after the opposition in the state and the government in the federal level. I think that story was important basically to outline how important social media is to discuss all of these issues and how having trolls to go after the opposition has become really a trend in Brazilian politics. It also suits for those who don't want to have their grievances properly addressed. So the São Paulo state government, by having those that online army, they can actually change the discussion from the water point, from the water crisis perspective, to crises that are at the federal level with the energy or in other issues. So I thought that story was important.
And it's related to one of your latest pieces called Brazil's Media Shrinks and Sponsored Trolls Make Political Debate Impossible. Give us a sense of what the status of Brazil's media is, and talk a little bit about the media shrinking there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brazil's media was very much TV-driven over the last 50 years or so. Since the education levels are not exactly fantastic in Brazil, they are slowly improving, but not to the extent that is needed. TV gets much more attention than other kinds of media. Because of that, TV is able to hold their workers at the moment. The Brazilian economy is going sluggish, but all the other media are really suffering. So print is suffering, radio is suffering too, and because of that, the coverage of every issue at a moment, Brazil's political situation is very complex and difficult. The discussion gets really watered down. It's really tough to see nice reports coming out. On the other side, you have people that are writing blogs or Twitters or doing vlogging, which is another trend in Brazilian politics now. They are being indirectly sponsored by political parties, and in São Paulo's case, by São Paulo government itself, under the excuse that the same company that does trolling is doing some kind of online consultancy, and that's making the political debate in Brazil very toxic. So the radicalization is very obvious. I don't know how long that's going to last, but it is very clear to discuss the water crisis, to discuss a potential energy crisis, and to discuss even the effects of the economy goes so sluggish, you'd need filters in the media that work properly, and that's not happening. So the trolls are taking over, in a way, the role of the media.
Hmm. Well, and Mauricio, what about the role of the corporate media versus independent media? What does that look like in Brazil?
Well, there is growing independent media, basically because there's many journalists out of work, so they're starting, they're going entrepreneurial a bit. But that depends, of course, on readers. And although Brazilians tend to be tech-savvy and very interested in social media, very interested in online media, we all know that to sponsor online media, it's much less obvious to big corporations than it is to sponsor a TV station like Global, which is one of the top 10 TVs in revenue in the world. So I would say that independent media, they do have a bigger slice than they used before, that they used to have, but still it's Global TV that leads the debate in a way. It's the newspapers that actually give Global TV things to talk about, and the water crisis, since it's not well covered in São Paulo state, it's very watered down in comparison to the economy discussions and to the political discussions in Brasilia. It is a bit trickier to have the issues flagged in time so we can actually discuss them in a public sphere.
Mauricio Savarese is a freelance journalist and former reporter with Reuters, based in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Matt Weiser is a freelance journalist and former reporter with the Sacramento Bee, and they both cover water and the environment. And we will put links to the stories they mentioned at yourcallradio.org. So, Mauricio, we want to talk about the politics involved in the water shortage in Brazil, but because this hasn't really been getting that much attention in the United States, talk about what you're facing there. I was just reading a story about Sao Paulo's drought by Philip Ross with the International Business Times. Really amazing photos of what's happening. He writes, "Photos of historic water crisis in Brazil show that the city is on the brink of collapse." Is that true?
Well, potentially. Let me give you a bit of a timeline of how things went. The first issues were flagged in 2004 when a big reservoir called Cantareira, which is actually used to provide water to about 9 million people in São Paulo and in the metropolitan region of São Paulo, that reservoir was already experiencing some difficulties. So the governor then, which is the same governor of now, a man called Geraldo Alckmin, he started doing some work on that, but not enough to address all the difficulties that they were having. He was focusing on other issues because he wanted to run for president in 2006. In 2011, the issue was so big that São Paulo government actually addressed addressed the New York Stock Exchange about the issue, because São Paulo's water utility, Sabesp, they have shares that are traded in New York. Still, after 2011, not much was done, and Geraldo Alckmin was governor again then. And now, last year, 2014, it was dramatic, because in the first 3 months of the year, there was basically no rain at the moment. We were supposed to have a lot of it. And it was also an election year. So it was very tricky for him, because he was going to run for re-election. He wants to bid for the presidency again in 2018. And all the alerts that could have been given last year, all the policies that could have been made to stem the crisis a bit, they were basically, there was basically nothing. They waited for the World Cup to end until the end of July, and then in disguise, some areas stopped getting water influxes every day. But the governor still said, well, there's no shortage, there's no difficulty with that. Only after he was reelected in October, they started implementing more drastic policies. So he offered a discount to those who could spare water. He started building some other constructions that could bring water from other reservoirs. But still, nothing has really made an impact, but the rains that came, the summer showers that we had this year. So just to finish the point on, so you can see how much we're close to the brink, people expected that São Paulo had at least 30% of that reservoir completely filled by the end of March, so that we knew that we'd have a lot of months without any rain, and then when the rain came again, there would be a chance of São Paulo resisting to them. Hmm. When March finished, São Paulo was at 22%. So it seems that it's not enough, and they're considering some drastic options. One of them is for some parts of the city to have water supply for just 2 days in the week, just two. So if that's not brink of collapse, I really don't know what it is.
I mean, and so, Mauricio, some people in California, the eighth largest economy in the world, are living without water today. Matt, have you been following what is happening in Brazil, and what strikes you about the similarities you're seeing in the coverage about California and Brazil?
Well, I've been following it peripherally. One of the things that strikes me as being similar is that there's a lot of politics involved in both cases. The parallel in California probably has to do with the politics of farming. And I touched on this a little bit in the story I wrote for National Geographic, but it boils down to the fact that farmers and the farm industry in California have kind of an outsized political sway. They're a fairly small part of the California economy, something like 2 to 4% of the total gross domestic product in California, but they are able to exert a fairly strong pull on state and federal politics when it comes to water issues. So that's why you see bills in Congress dealing with California water supply. It's why you see recently the governor and President Obama touring a dried up farm in the San Joaquin Valley. Although these farms are a relatively small part of the economy, they're an iconic part of California. It's a part of the economy that everyone can identify with in some way. And as a result, farms can exert a lot of political influence.
Matt, what are your thoughts on how that piece has been covered? Earlier this week, we did a show about agriculture and the politics behind water, who's really calling the shots. And Daniel Beard, who's a former commissioner with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, he continually brought the conversation back to agriculture. And he said, you know, no offense, but your guests seem to be avoiding the issue that ag is really getting a pass from Governor Brown. What are your thoughts on how that's been covered?
Well, it's been touched on, but I don't think it's really been explored as much as it should be. And I would agree that agriculture more or less got a pass from Governor Brown when the governor imposed a 25% mandatory conservation order on urban water agencies in the state. He did nothing to require conservation from agriculture. The response, however, is always that, well, agriculture has already had its water supplies cut back, and as a result, there's been hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland fallowed, and so that's a kind of conservation. But for the farms that continue to have water, there haven't been any conservation requirements. And one of the relevant points about that is that something more than 40% of all the agricultural land in California is still irrigated by some kind of flood irrigation, which is extremely wasteful when it comes to water use, at least compared to newer irrigation methods like micro sprinklers or drip irrigation. So there have been efforts to spool up more grant type programs to help farmers switch to thriftier irrigation, but there was nothing like that in the governor's announcement, and as far as I know, there haven't been any new widespread efforts to expand those kinds of irrigation programs to farms.
Matt Weiser is a freelance journalist and a former senior reporter with the Sacramento Bee. Mauricio Savarese is a freelance journalist and former reporter with Reuters based in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Today we are talking about media coverage of the drought from California to Brazil. And if you'd like to join us, what really stands out for you in the coverage that you've been reading? So many things have been getting attention over the past couple of months: groundwater, food choices, bottled water, Californians living without water. The politics is getting some attention. A lot of people are now learning about Stuart Resnick and the almond orchards that he owns, his very close ties to the Democratic Party in California. So where are you getting your information from about water? What are your thoughts on the context about how we got here and the politics behind water? 866-798-8255. And if you have any specific questions for Mauricio Savarese about what's happening in Brazil, now would be a good time to call. He'll be leaving us in about 8 minutes. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Mauricio, how is this being framed in the Brazilian media or the Brazilian blogs, because they have so much prominence? The Earth Island Institute had a piece about how policies have contributed to water scarcity in Brazil. And according to the piece, the rise of biofuels, especially ethanol, was mentioned as a major global factor contributing to water scarcity. Ethanol is made from corn and sugarcane, and 50% of sugarcane grown in Brazil is used for ethanol production. Is that getting a lot of attention there?
Well, not really, especially because since Brazil had those major discoveries of the pre-salt layer oil, the discussion about biofuels has really disappeared, not only in the media, but even if you go to economic forums here, it's not nearly as important as it was 5 or 6 years ago. What has been really discussed at this moment is inefficiency, because São Paulo's water utility estimates about 27% of waste, just because of the pipes and the way the water is channeled to homes in São Paulo. So there is a massive inefficiency issue, which is being a bit discussed in the media more than other issues that are also important. And one of them is the path that industries got. They are not supposed to cut any of the waste they have with water. That comes because Brazil has been in a very sluggish moment in its economy. So the economy last year grew 0%, and this year it is supposed to shrink at about 1%, the country's GDP. So they don't want to take on the corporations, the big corporations that waste water as well. They're basically expecting that homeowners are going to pay for the bill and try to waste less water than they used to. I don't know if you have that trend in California too, because I was there recently and I didn't get the chance to ask. But Brazilians are obsessed with showers, and we take at least a shower a day or two, depending on how hot it is, and that is the major source for home waste. And there's loads of stories about personal engagement with the crisis, about people spending less, but there is not as much of putting the blame and giving some accountability charges to the São Paulo government. That's much less than I'd expect in a similar crisis. When I was in California, I talked to a few reporters of the LA Times who worked in the Sacramento Senate, and they said they're printing stories much more often than we actually do here. So there is an issue with transparency in the media in that regard as well.
Well, let's hear from a few listeners. Let's go to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose and guests. As you know, the Olympics in 2016 are going to be held in Rio de Janeiro. And I was wondering whether or not, since on my world map, Sao Paulo looks fairly close to Rio, if Rio is having a similar water crisis.
Well, that's a good question. Sao Paulo is at about 400 kilometers away from Rio, but it's experiencing a crisis of its own. There are some cities in the southern state of Rio which are also experiencing difficulties because the rain is not falling as much as used to also in that part. But for Rio, there's really not a big issue eyeing the Olympics next year. The two regions that are being most affected at the moment is Sao Paulo state, in the part where Sao Paulo is, and a bit of the Minas Gerais state, which is a state which are basically the two biggest state economies in Brazil. So, but Rio so far hasn't been as affected as these other two.
And I'm wondering if you have questions for each other, since you were just here, Mauricio, and you both cover the same issues. Mauricio, do you have any questions for Matt?
I do. When I was in California, I was there in a State Department program on transparency and accountability, and we were asking people in the California Senate, people that are controllers in big cities, Is California being transparent with their citizens about the water crisis and the facts and the difficulties that they're going to experience? Most of them said yes, but these are all government officials. So I'd like to hear from a colleague in the media how transparent it feels. How transparent it feels.
Well, that's a good question. I don't think they've been very transparent up until recently. When you started to hear water agency managers talk a lot more about how hard it's going to be to get people to conserve. This 25% requirement that the government just imposed, that's got water agencies very concerned because, number one, they haven't been able to meet the conservation goals that are in place now. And they have not been willing to do a lot of hard enforcement on their customers with things like fines and warnings. They're hoping to just do it through encouragement, and it's not working. So only now that there's this 25% mandate are they starting to sound honest about how difficult this is going to be. Another area where I think they may not have been so far as transparent as they could be has to do with the money behind delivering this water. When people conserve, the water agencies get less revenue, and that causes all kinds of budget problems for the local water agencies. And often that leads them to do things like increase the cost of water to their customers, which just produces more complaints from their customers. And they're not talking about that very much. I think it's a subject they don't want to touch.
And Matt, hold that thought. I'll ask you more about that after the break. And Mauricio, I know we have to let you go, so thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure. Always available to you guys.
Thank you. Mauricio Savarese is a freelance journalist and former reporter with Reuters based in Sao Paulo. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Public Radio, KALW. We invite you to join today's conversation. The number to call is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Pardon me, no, it's not today. Today it's Inflection Point with Lauren Schiller, and following that at noon, the Tavis Smiley Show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will talk about the disappearance of bees and butterflies. We did a show about this about 6 months ago, and we're going to get an update. Why aren't we seeing more bees and butterflies? And we're going to talk about efforts to bring them back, hopefully. That's Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are discussing media coverage of California's water crisis. This week, we've done shows on groundwater, agriculture, the politics behind water, and bottled water. And you can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Matt Weiser, a freelance reporter and former senior reporter with the Sacramento Bee, where he covers water and the environment. And now I would like to welcome Lisa Krieger to the show. Lisa is an award-winning journalist and science writer with the San Jose Mercury News, where she covers science, medicine, and California's drought. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. So I want to say thank you because on yesterday's show about groundwater, I referred to your piece that you wrote back in March about the San Joaquin Valley sinking as farmers race to tap the aquifer. And before we get back to calls, we've got a bunch of people on the line. I just want to ask you, you did such a good job of really explaining the drilling process, especially in your video where you compared some of these wells to the size of the Empire State Building. And even as someone who's been covering these issues for years on this show, before seeing that video, it was really hard to come up with a visual. So can you talk about the media, you know, explaining what this looks like to citizens who might be very disconnected from a place like the Central Valley?
Yeah, thank you, Rose. You know, it wasn't that many generations ago when we were much more of a rural landscape and we all had wells in our backyard, and it was something we were familiar with. And they tended to be hand-dug and shallow and provided a lot of water. So what we're seeing, particularly in the Central Valley, when there's no surface water being allocated by the state, the agricultural community goes to groundwater because it's what they have, and it's privately owned in the wells in their backyard or their field or their pasture. And what we tried to show in this piece was really the race to the bottom. You know, what's happening as the water level drops because it's being drained. People are having to dig deeper and deeper and deeper for wells. Now, of course, how this plays out is if you're a very modest family farmer with a very old and shallow well, you've lost your water. If you've got deeper pockets, like some of the big cotton farmers, the Resniks and all, particularly down in southern San Joaquin, they have the resources to go very deep, extraordinarily deep. The technology has become so advanced. So what we tried to show was that as larger agribusiness is dropping huge deep wells quickly, that it's really hurting the family farmers. And we had the privilege of riding around with a driller. This was very early on. This was last spring. And already at that point, he was booked maybe 7, 8, 9 months in advance. And we were able to watch the process, which was truly extraordinary. If you've never seen it, it's very high-tech. It's very messy. It's just water and mud all over. And then we tried to really describe for readers in a way they'd understand how deep these wells are going to get the water they need. And then, and finally, then what I did was when I came back to the office, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, and I got well drilling permit data from 7 or 8 of the counties in the Central Valley where we could really document month by month and year by year the demand for new wells. And what we saw was that the demand had really skyrocketed as surface water became more restricted. This is not data that, at least at that point, the state was collecting, so it really fell on journalists to say, to go to each county and say, let us see your logs, let us see your permit data. And it, as you may have discussed, this data does not track the actual volume of water coming out, but it is a record of the demand for wells and how deep these wells are going.
Right. I mean, that was the other shocking part of your piece is that there are so many permits being given out, and it's almost like they're racing to grab the last drops.
Exactly. Yep.
Matt, what are your thoughts about explanations like this? I mean, Lisa did such a good job of just laying it all out with a video so you can visualize it, and then just in detail, really looking at who's getting the permits and where they're drilling.
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing to describe. And unfortunately, I think stories like Lisa's have become the exception rather than the rule in coverage of these issues. It's a great thing that she was able to do that story, but we need a lot more stories like that to understand this issue, because it's very complicated. There's a lot of moving parts, a lot of agencies involved, a lot of private landowners involved, some of whom are very wealthy and control a lot of land. So it takes time, it takes resources to get to the bottom of these things.
You also did a really good job of looking at the numbers with your almond story, because so many of the stories about almonds tend to be kind of sensational, but you really looked at the prices of almonds, how much they're selling for, agriculture water in some parts of the state selling for $2,500 per acre, almonds commanding such a high price, now approaching $4 a pound. We also talked yesterday about the importance of distinguishing between the small farmers and the corporate farmers.
Right. Well, thanks for pointing that out. Yeah, a lot of the, there's been a lot of stories recently about almonds and the role they have in water shortages and the drought, and some of them have been a bit sensational. I tried to point out that a lot of this is market-driven, and it's not like farmers are out there trying to monopolize all the water. They're simply responding to what the market wants, and what the market wants is almonds. So they're doing whatever they can to grow almonds, and it has lots of ripple effects on the environment and on water supply in California. It's an interesting situation because so many of these almonds are being exported all over the world, largely to China. Most of the exported almonds go to China. So in a sense, you can say that some of this water is a means of exporting water to other countries. The water that it took, that is essentially contained in those almonds, is, for all intents and purposes, never coming back to California. So it raises a lot of big questions about how we manage water and how we manage cropping patterns in the state.
Matt Weiser is a freelance reporter and a former senior reporter with the Sacramento Bee. Lisa Krieger is an award-winning journalist and science writer with the San Jose Mercury News. Today we are talking about media coverage of water issues. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie-Louise. Welcome
Hello.
To the show.
Hello. Good morning. What I have to say is no news, but I wanted to bring to the attention, to people who haven't heard it, that I would say it's about 4 years ago, I heard that there was a part of India, and a fairly large part, where they had no rain for 9 years, which, of course, meant no livestock, nothing growing, and no water to even think of getting a hold of. And, you know, I think I grew up with a kind of a reverence for water. I've been on the earth for over 70 years, and we really treated water as something we were thankful for all the time, whether we drank it or you know, had showers or anything that had to do with water. So I just would like it if people might think about that the impossible isn't always impossible. So a drought can last like that, and often I feel like we're acting on this earth like the people on Easter Island did. You know, we're raping it, we're tapping it, we're taking everything out of it, and then in many cases we're poisoning it from above.
Marie-Louise, what do you think about the media coverage so far?
Well, I think, for example, you have been fantastic with the programs that you have had lately. So I really, really appreciate that. As far as all the newspapers that come my way, I don't think there's enough at all. But I really, you know, you're just right there awake and with it all the time.
Well, thank you. And we have a related question from Amy, who wrote in on email. It's obvious the media are underplaying the drought. Part of the problem is lack of activism statewide regarding policies. If activist groups were on the steps of Sacramento regarding water, there would be no coverage. What are your thoughts on that, Lisa?
I disagree. I think we saw this on Tuesday. California regulators unanimously adopted really tough emergency drought regulations, and the board chair Felisa Marcus called it an all hands on deck kind of moment. Now there were 100 people there in the audience pleading their cases for why they needed more time and why they deserved special extenuating circumstances, and she was quite direct in saying, we're beyond the worst case scenario, these are extraordinary times, and things need to change starting June 1st. And just to get back to your point about media coverage, this is, for me, it's been just so heartening to watch local, smaller newspapers, regional newspapers, stepping up to the plate and translating for readers what Felisa Marcus and the Water Resources Board said about state water targets and saying, this is what it means for you. In Fremont, Milpitas, Marin, Woodside and Portola Valley, Woodside particularly in Atherton, which have had extraordinarily high water consumption, each of these regions has to hit a different target. It's a very local story. It's a very local story. And it's really provided this amazing opportunity for local media to talk to people and say, let us tell you what this means for you in Woodside, and which is going to be different than what it means for you in Santa Cruz and what it means for you in Marin. There are 11 different tiers now of agencies, nine different tiers, I'm sorry, with 411 different water agencies hitting different targets. And I think the media is actually, given how limited our resources are, I think we've done a pretty good job.
And Matt, what are your thoughts on that?
I guess I have a slightly different opinion. I sympathize with people who might say that the coverage has been modest up until recently. I've been covering the drought since it began over 3 years ago, more or less full time, because of the nature of the beat that I had at the Sacramento Bee. But I didn't really see a lot of other media get seriously interested until pretty recently, when the governor came out with his 25% requirement. There was ongoing coverage, there was interest, but after that announcement, when the governor used his bully pulpit for that requirement, I saw a lot more interest from not only media in the state, but media outside the state, and suddenly it was on everybody's radar. And I think that also that the coverage has been a bit superficial in a lot of cases. There has been a lot of coverage of the 25% requirement, and before that, the 20% requirement or request for conservation that has been in place for the year prior to this. But there haven't been a lot of questions asked about why the requirements haven't been met, why there hasn't been more enforcement, why these water agencies all over the state have not stepped up and demanded compliance. And one reason is that they're afraid of upsetting their customers. Another is that many of them don't have the resources or the money to put enforcement staff on the street. Those are the kind of stories that really need to be covered more, I think.
Matt Weiser is a freelance journalist and former reporter with the Sacramento Bee. Lisa Krieger is a science writer with the San Jose Mercury News. And today we're talking about media coverage of California's water crisis. Thank you for the call, Marie-Louise, and thanks for the email, Amy. You can join us at 866-798-8255. Email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from Michael in Berkeley. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hello, my name is Michael Warburton, and I'm executive director of a group, a nonprofit called the Public Trust Alliance, and we try to emphasize the fact that by law in California, water is a public trust. And I've been working on this issue for more than 20 years, and the discussions. I was at that meeting in Sacramento on Tuesday, And I made a comment in the public forum part of the meeting that said, well, hang on a second. This board are trustees appointed by the state to manage California's water for public benefit, not only for this generation, but future generations. And, you know, in public forum, you're not allowed to comment on items on the agenda, but rather items that are within the jurisdiction of the board, but which are sometimes avoided. And the thing is that this water has a history in California that's very long. And at one point in 1884, the major industry of California was mining, and water was used to hydraulic mine and to wash whole hillsides, whole mountains. And essentially what happened was this debris from hydraulic mining clogged the rivers, and it was the first environmental case in California, which is basically that the major industry of California was a public nuisance.
Michael, I hate to cut you off, but we have a bunch of callers. Do you have a question for our guests about these issues and how journalists should cover them? Did we lose Michael? All right, let's go. Sorry about that,
Lisa,
Michael.
If you don't mind, Lisa. Rose, let me just jump in a little bit here. I think Michael's hit on a great point, and we will see more coverage about that, and that is the issue of water markets. You know, water's essential for life, but it's also a private commodity that you see bought and sold much as you would on, you know, products on the stock exchange.
So where do you think that is going? And as a reporter, how difficult is it to get that kind of information?
It's tough. These markets are not transparent at all. There might be an irrigation district that has some that makes sense for them to sell because they've had it, and they can ship it and sell it for very high prices. It's not transparent. It's not like you can go to the, you know, Morningstar and look at what water's trading for at that moment. I do have a little bit of mixed feelings, and that is, you know, that as water gets more expensive, people will treat it much more carefully. But that being said, it's absolutely critical, and everyone needs access to it.
Matt, have
but
you looked?
Thanks for identifying the issue.
Yeah, thank you. And Matt, have you looked at this issue?
Not so much water trading per se, but if I could follow up on the issues raised by the caller as well, there's a principle in state law called reasonable use. Anyone who holds a water right in California is required to put that water to quote unquote reasonable use, and that's a kind of an ephemeral term, but it's up to the state water board to decide when something is reasonable or not. And there have been calls recently for the board to use that law to control how water is used in some cases, particularly farming. There might be cases where a farmer is growing a very thirsty crop in a dry climate simply because they have the water available. And theoretically, under the law, the water board could say that is not a reasonable use of water given the drought that we're in, and so we are going to put your water right on hold. You will not be able to divert that water. And I bring this up only as an example. I don't intend to scapegoat farmers completely. There are examples in the urban sector of unreasonable water use too, but so far we have not seen the water board make any noises about using that portion of the law. We may see that happen later this year as we head into summer and this drought starts to get really ugly.
Well, thank you for calling in, Michael. Let's go next to Juliet in San Francisco. Hi, Juliet.
Hi, thanks for having me. I really appreciate both of your guests' writings on water, and they're some of the few that actually provide the context, and I feel like that's really what's been missing in a lot of cases. We're in a drought right now. We've been in droughts in the past, and we'll be in droughts in the future, more severe and longer droughts based on climate science. And really understanding how we got here You know, we have had the 20 by 2020 law in place. We had the Water Conservation Act of 2009 that asked all agricultural districts to measure their water and start charging customers based on the volume of water used. We've had all of these efforts that haven't led to real change. And kind of putting this drought into context and saying, what can we learn? What do we need to do in terms of systemic transformative change? I think reasonable use, which was just being discussed, is a huge part of that. But that hasn't made its way into almost any of the media coverage. So I'm really looking for media to be providing readers with more information about how we got here and how we can do better in the future, because we absolutely have to.
It's a great question. Thank you, Lisa. We've been talking about this in our water series, and some of the guests say that the way that it's framed is really misleading. It's a very political situation, and you can look at reasons why we are here today. What are your thoughts about that and how the media are tackling those issues?
Boy, you know, we tend not to, you know, we're a newspaper, so we write about what happened yesterday, what likely happened tomorrow. We're not as good on the deep history, and we try to with the longer pieces. And I think the point is excellent, and it's a really important reminder. And I think she's absolutely right in that there really is a cultural change and an aesthetic change. When you go to Santa Fe, you imagine a city of beautiful desert, brown, tan, gold. When you come to my town of Palo Alto, it's green and lush. And boy, you know, that's absolutely, we need to reframe how we think of California.
And Matt, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I would agree completely. I think the caller makes a great point. There's a tremendous amount of context in history that explains how we got where we are now. And it rarely comes up in news stories, which, of course, usually deal with what just happened yesterday or what's going to happen tomorrow. For example, let's just look at population. California's population has almost doubled since the drought of 1977. And so when people wonder why there's less water to go around now, even though the drought, some people claim this drought still isn't as bad as 77. Some people say it's about the same. So why all the anxiety? Well, there's nearly twice as many people in California, all of them drinking water and taking showers and swimming in pools and all of that. Another big change back to agriculture is the shift towards lots of permanent crops like almonds and mandarin oranges and wine grapes. A lot of agricultural land has been transformed into permanent crops that require the same amount of water every year, no matter what the weather is. Previously, more of that land was in annual crops that could be fallowed or switched to something that consumed less water during a drought. All of these things have increased water demand during this drought, and we need to hear more discussion of that kind of context.
And once again, what is it like for you as a reporter to get information about these corporate farms? And, I mean, again, Lisa does a really good job of listing some of these farms that are opening in, like, the wine country, for example. I'm just trying to get the – here it is. She's got information, for example, the Livermore-based wine group, the world's third-largest wine producer, in 2012 bought a Chowchilla ranch and converted it to grapes. Paramount Farms, the world's largest pistachio and almond grower, converted 15,000 acres of row cropland in Madera County. I mean, the list just goes on. What is it like for you both to report on these specific productions?
It's really difficult because it's private. I was able to find it information by talking to local farm bureaus, by reading clips, by, you know, describing debates there on the very local, you know, evening meetings of the local city council. But it's really hard. Matt may be better at it than I am.
No, I agree. It's very hard, especially with companies like Paramount Farms, which is a big landowner, very big company, lots of products and tentacles, but it's entirely privately held. There are ways to get some of the information when it enters the public sphere, like when they do a water transfer deal or when they buy land or when they make a presentation at a meeting, but otherwise it's pretty difficult. There are lots of ways to kind of dance around the issue to gather information on the periphery, but it's hard to know what these companies are doing a lot of the time.
Yeah, and this Paramount Farms is owned by the billionaire Stuart Resnick, right?
Correct.
Yep.
And just briefly, we've got about a minute. Go ahead, Lisa.
Jump in. You know, wells are on private property, right? So it's entirely Resnick's prerogative to drop wells. And he can report the casing on it. He can report the depth, things that have safety and regulatory concerns. But that's been something typically that's been off limits to the state, which is changing now. And that's what makes this really hard.
A few people have written in about corporate farms, saying the media are giving them a pass. One listener says, why can't graduated water taxes be used to encourage voluntary big ag water conservation? Are you familiar with that, Lisa?
Not as much as I should be. You know, when the state was discussing required cutbacks, everyone said that ag was overlooked and got a pass and all that. The reality is ag's already been cut big time with State Water Project and the Central Valley Water Project. Absolutely, more cuts are coming their way, but they're feeling this too.
Lisa Krieger is an award-winning journalist and science writer with the San Jose Mercury News. Matt Weiser is a freelance journalist and former reporter with the Sacramento Bee, and you can find their work at yourcallradio.org. Lisa and Matt, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Where are the bees and the butterflies? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about efforts to restore their habitat. Thousands of species of bees and butterflies are under threat, with 90% of the world's flowering species requiring insects or animals for pollination. How is the decline of bees and butterflies affecting our food supply and our landscapes? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.